Welcome back to the program. Back in 1994, amidst the Republican takeover of Congress and the Clinton administration, Bill Clinton decided to focus on many small initiatives in order to try and score some political victories with a hostile Congress. Time magazine put Clinton on the cover with the headline, "The Incredible Shrinking Presidency." The principal architect of that strategy was Rahm Emanuel, at the time a Clinton aide and currently the White House Chief of Staff. Cut to January 2009. Barack Obama is elected with a healthy majority. He has a filibuster-proof Senate and an overwhelming majority in the House. Rahm Emanuel is now the White House Chief of Staff and argues for a similar strategy. The president instead sees and strives for a more bold vision and more audacious goals. Perhaps in that conflict lies the seeds of the current political crisis that the White House finds itself in. Yesterday, the cover story in the New York Times Magazine by my guest Peter Baker looks at that conflict and the role of White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel as the lightning rod of the current political problems. Peter Baker is a veteran of covering the White House, presidents, and Rahm Emanuel. He is currently the White House correspondent for the New York Times, and it is my pleasure to have him here today to talk about his New York Times story, The Limits of Rahmism. Peter Baker, welcome back to the program.
Hi there. How are you today?
Good to have you here. One of the things that you point out in the article is that Obama, in picking Rahm Emanuel, was avoiding the mistakes of some other Democratic presidents, particularly Clinton and Carter before him, in picking somebody that really knew the ways of Washington.
Well, that's right, exactly. Somebody who he had a relationship with but was not simply a friend from his hometown. I mean, look, we've seen this many times. It's hard to translate success in the private sector or success in other political arenas to the White House, and he didn't want to have that happen. It's an interesting dichotomy, of course. You've got this president who sort of positioned himself as an outsider coming in to clean up Washington. He'd only spent 2 years in the Senate before running off to run for president, picking the guy who's sort of the ultimate insider. And, you know, that's sort of the central tension of this White House, or probably a lot of White Houses, I suppose, between idealism and pragmatism, where, you know, what point do you say, no, I'm going to go for everything I believe in? What point do you say, no, that's enough, I'm going to make a deal?
There's also the conflict inherent in this between campaigning and what is said and goes on in the context of a campaign and what's involved in governing, especially given the nature of Washington today.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, every time you go out there on a campaign trail and you make promises, especially if you're not an incumbent, you know, you don't have the responsibility of actually making it come true until much, much later. And you see it time and again as people get into the office and they discover that it's not everything they thought it was, or that their options are more narrow than they thought that they should be. And in the end, the president is not a monarch. He has to contend with a Congress, even of his own party, that has its own mind about things.
The other thing, it's so interesting looking at the totality of it. There was a Harvard study a number of years ago that for new CEOs coming into a big corporation, that no matter how, even within that kind of hierarchical structure, that it takes 3 to 5 years to make profound changes and to really change the culture of a company. And yet we expect that in Washington and the White House overnight.
Oh, I think that's a fair point. I mean, this is the third president I've had a chance to cover, and every time you see, it takes a while until they become presidential. There's a certain point in a presidency in which a president sort of, you know, learned the balance and how to lead, in the everything from the way they stand and pose in a picture to the way they interact with Congress and the public. And you know, there's no preparation for that job, absolutely none. Even a vice president, probably the closest you could come to that job, doesn't really have it until you actually sat in the Oval Office and seen the choices that are presented to you.
Talk a little bit about what the initial game plan was and how they envisioned the first year of this administration going, not only what they wanted to accomplish, but how they thought they could use the stimulus bill, the crises that exist at the time, and build on those victories. And as you mentioned, there was a sort of game plan, but it all went by the boards.
Well, they had the idea that they were going to have a sort of a big bang approach. They're going to push a lot of big things all at once rather than sequencing. In some ways, what President Clinton had tried to do was to take things one at a time, one big issue at a time. They weren't going to do that here. They're going to push forward on all fronts, and they hoped that one victory would beget another. You know, the success would lead to more success. The stimulus would lead to health care, would lead to climate change, would lead to financial regulations, and so forth. Obviously, that didn't happen quite the way they thought it would. They had a a lot of success early on in terms of some big legislation with stimulus and with, you know, limits on credit card abuses and tobacco manufacturing and advertising and so forth. But, you know, in the last 6 to 9 months, Congress has been so absorbed completely in healthcare that obviously is still an uncertain outcome that not a lot else has gotten through.
There's also the sense, and you talk about this later in the piece, of the utter exhaustion of so many of these people, particularly Rahm Emanuel, who you talk about, and it's hard to imagine good decisions and big-picture thinking being done in the context of this kind of day-to-day exhaustion.
Yeah, I think the White House, by definition, is a burnout place that is built for people who are young and have energy. And, you know, Rahm Emanuel probably has more energy than any other 50-year-old on the planet, and I think even he's, exhausted at times trying to keep up with all the different things. I mean, think about it. This is a president who came in with two wars ongoing, plus the broader terrorist threat that we saw manifested again on Christmas Day, an economic crisis the likes of which no president has confronted in generations, a crisis of confidence to some extent in the broader public at home and abroad. So, you know, those are not small issues, and they're not issues that were going to be solved overnight, and perhaps they were overly optimistic about how quickly they thought they could do a lot of this stuff. I think they've come to understand that it wasn't going to happen as quickly as they thought.
Was the president, do you think, as over-optimistic about it?
I think so, sure. I think all of them were to some extent. I mean, look, they had this idea that by the end of the first year, they were going to have closed Guantanamo, they were going to have health care passed, they were going to have climate change passed, they were going to have financial regulations passed, they were going to have an arms control treaty with Russia, they were going to have restarted the Middle East peace talks, they would have some sort of new relationship with Iran, and none of that happened. Now, a lot of things have happened, but none of that, all those things were on their plate, and they expected by the end of year one they didn't happen. They raised these expectations. Now they're saying, look, you're holding us to too high a standard, but it's a standard they themselves set.
Talk a little bit about the beginnings of this presidency and what the conflicts were, as you outline them in the story, between Rahm Emanuel and the president in terms of small incremental steps versus bold, audacious steps.
Well, at various points along the way in the first year, Rahm Emanuel would say to the president, look, maybe we should, go for a health care bill that expands coverage of children and low-income families and takes care of some of these insurance abuses, and declare victory. That's a pretty big deal in and of itself. And at each moment, the president says, no, I'm not ready to do that. I don't want to pare back. We're going for the big thing because this is a once-in-a-generation chance. If we don't get it done now, there's no guarantee we'll ever get a chance to do it again. So, we're testing that thesis. We're testing that gamble. This is the difference between a poker player and the president who is, pushes all his chips onto the table, and a poker player in Rahm Emanuel who looks at the cards and decides when he's going to play and when he's going to fold and tries to, husband his victories and not set himself up for big defeats.
The irony, though, is that assuming this passes, and maybe there's a 51% chance of that at the moment, that it has been chipped away to the point that Rahm Emanuel's approach might have been right from the beginning.
Well, it might have. I mean, I think that's the subject of a huge debate in Washington right now, and we're going to know a lot more in a week. If this gets through on 216 votes in the House by the end of this week, people are going to say, well, that's turned out to be the right thing, at least on the Democratic side. A lot of people will say that. Then we'll see again in the fall. If, in fact, it costs them politically, then the judgment could be very different.
Talk a little bit about bipartisanship and the way Rahm Emanuel has tried to bring that, or certainly did in the beginning, and instead became the lightning rod for his own party.
Well, that's right. I mean, look, he's right now the bête noire of liberals in his own party, particularly who think he has not fought hard enough for the things they care most about. In health care, that would be, for instance, the public option. And they see him as being way too willing to cave to conservative interests and moderates in the party. His argument on the flip side would be none of these people ever actually passed anything. And the way of Washington is, you have to go where the votes are.
To what extent has Rahm Emanuel's problems been problems of perception and the way he sort of managed his own image?
Well, I mean, look, he is a larger-than-life figure. He is certainly the most prominent chief of staff we've had in more than a decade. He's somebody who came in as an independent political actor, a member of Congress, a person of his own elected experience. So, you know, that's good and bad. It attracts a lot of attention. It means during moments of success, he's going to, you know, be a celebrated figure. It means during moments of difficulty and challenges, these last few months have been, he's going to be a figure of controversy and criticism.
One of the particularly interesting things that you point out in the story is that many of these problems are of his own making in some ways, of his own success, because of all the moderates that he helped get elected to Congress in 2006.
Well, that's right. Rahm Emanuel was head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee in 2006, and one of the things he did to try to take back the Congress from the Republicans was to recruit a lot of candidates in conservative moderate districts that hadn't really elected a lot of Democrats in the past to do that. It meant he recruited candidates who were pro-gun and pro-life and people who turn out to be skeptical of some of this health care stuff. So, you know, on the other hand, the flip side is, of course, if he hadn't won those districts, they wouldn't have the majority they have to begin with.
Where is Rahm Emanuel politically in all of this?
Well, I think on some issues he is, you know, centrist in his leaning, certainly on national security and things like that. But he also, I mean, his ideology is about how much he can get done. You know, I think sometimes he's misunderstood. He on a lot of liberal priorities, he'll take as much as he can get. He just makes a judgment about how far he can get, and that's where he decides to cut the deal. Others who are more, you know, passionate sometimes about these causes fault him for not trying to push further.
Talk about the relationship between the president and Rahm Emanuel through all of this and how they've managed their disagreements at times about some of this policy.
Well, it's misunderstood. I mean, they're friends, but not the friends that a lot of people think they are. Rahm Emanuel was from Chicago, like the president. They're Democrats, held office together, but he didn't go through the fires of the campaign. He's not as close to him as, in a personal, intimate sense, as David Axelrod or Valerie Jarrett or Robert Gibbs, and he didn't even endorse him during the primary campaign, stayed neutral between Obama and Hillary Clinton. So, you know, the relationship is one of you know, it is friendly, obviously, and they obviously get along pretty well, I think. But they're very different temperamental people, and I think that I think there's something, you know, in the coarse and caustic Emanuel that kind of appeals to the sort of more, you know, calm and cool, collected president. Maybe a side of him that he himself doesn't show very often.
And how have Republicans dealt with Rahm Emanuel? You talk about his relationship with Lindsey Graham, who perhaps he has the closest personal relationship with. How have Republicans in general dealt with him?
Well, most Republicans look at him as a, you know, as a somebody who is out to get them, they're probably right on some level. And they don't. A lot of them don't believe in his bipartisan rhetoric. They think it's tactical for advantage for the Democrats rather than a genuine reaching out to them.
You really get the sense in reading your story that this is a guy truly between a rock and a hard place right now.
Well, I think that's exactly right. This is a very difficult moment for him, and so much is on the line. His profile is way too high for a staffer at this point, a lot of people would say. And, you know, we're going to get the verdict in one sense, at least one of the verdicts, probably in the next 6-7 days.
And does everything ride on that for Emanuel?
At the moment, it does, I think, yes. I think, you know, I mean, that's, you know, let's keep perspective. There are going to be other issues in other moments, but they've put everything behind this right now.
And when one looks at that, is there a second chance? If this passes, what happens?
Well, if this passes, then they have to fight to convince the public that it was a good thing. It's a whole new battle at that point, but it's one that they would rather have than the other one.
How does the president view such a high profile for his chief of staff right now?
Well, he's been irritated by some of the stories that have been out there, irritated at the whole distraction that it's caused. But, you know, he for the moment he's shown every sign that he still feels like he needs Rahm Emanuel to manage his White House.
Do you think that he's there for the rest of at least this term?
I think he's there for the rest of this year, you know. I think his plan was always, you know, I mean, 2 years is a pretty normal time for a White House chief of staff, so it wouldn't surprise me if by next year he was looking around doing something else. But he'll be there, I think, the rest of this year.
New York Times White House correspondent Peter Baker, his story, The Limits of Rahmism, is the cover story in the New York Times magazine that was out yesterday. Peter, it is always a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Great. Thanks very much. Appreciate
it. Thank you.